I'd always expected that the Cambridge years would be the easiest part of the book to write. I'd been a student there myself, not long after Lang, and the place hadn't changed much. And it was just as well, I thought, looking at the manuscript, because once again my memories would have to stand in for Lang's. He'd gone up to read economics, briefly played football for his college's second 11, and had won a reputation as a student actor. Yet he seemed oddly evasive about the whole period. "I can hardly remember anything about it," he said. I wasn't much good, to be honest. Acting was basically just an opportunity to meet girls. But when I was in London, I read interviews with people who said you were good enough to become a professional. "I suppose I wouldn't have minded," Lang conceded, "at one stage, except that you don't change things by being an actor. Only politicians can do that." "And what about Cambridge?" I persisted. "It must have been hugely important coming from your background." "Yes, I enjoyed my time there. It wasn't the real world, though. It was fantasy land." "I know. That was what I liked about it." "And so did I. In fact, just between the two of us, I loved it." Lang's eyes gleamed at the memory. "To go out onto a stage and pretend to be someone else and to have people applaud you for doing it. What could be better?" "Great," I said. "Let's put that in." "No." "Why not?" "Why not?" Lang sighed. "Because these are the memoirs of a prime minister." He suddenly pounded his hand hard against the side of his chair. "And all my political life, whenever my opponents have been really stuck for something to hit me with, they've always said I was an actor." He sprang up and started striding up and down. "Oh, Adam Lang," he drawled, performing a pitch-perfect caricature of an upper-class Englishman. "Have you noticed the way he changes his voice to suit whatever company he's in?
You can't believe anything the wee bastard said. The man's a performer, just piss and wind in a suit."
And now he became pompous, judicious, hand-wringing.
"It is Mr. Lang's tragedy that an actor can only be as good as the part he is given. And finally, this Prime Minister has run out of lines."
"You'll recognise that last one from your no doubt extensive researches."
I shook my head. I was too astonished by his tirade to speak.
"It's from the editorial in the Times on the day I announced my resignation. The headline was, 'Kindly leave the stage.' So no, if you don't mind, we won't dwell on my years as a student actor."
For a little while, neither of us spoke. Then I heard a click and leaned across to check the recorder. "I need to change tapes," I said, grateful for the opportunity to get away. I went downstairs to where the secretaries were typing. Emilia turned around as I came in. I suppose my face must have given me away.
"What's happened?" she said.
"Nothing." But then I felt an urge to share my unease.
"Actually, he seems a bit on edge."
Emilia carried on looking at me.
"He took a call just after you finished your session this morning."
"But from whom?"
"He didn't tell me. I wonder, Alice, darling, do you mind?"
Alice got up and Emilia slipped into position in front of the computer screen. I don't think I ever saw fingers move so rapidly across a keyboard. And then the clicks slowed to a few staccato taps as Emilia found what she was looking for. She tilted the screen towards me, then sat back in her chair in disbelief. I bent to read it. The web page was headed Breaking News, January 27th, 2:57 p.m. Eastern Time, New York. Former British Foreign Secretary Richard Reichardt has asked the International Criminal Court in The Hague to investigate allegations that the former British Prime Minister, Adam Lang, ordered the illegal handover of suspects for torture by the CIA. Mr. Reichardt, who was dismissed from the cabinet by Mr. Lang 4 years ago, is currently the United Nations Special Envoy for Humanitarian Affairs and an outspoken critic of US foreign policy. In a statement issued from his office in New York, Mr. Reichardt said, "I have repeatedly asked the British government in private to investigate this illegal act, yet the government have consistently refused even to acknowledge the existence of Operation Tempest. I therefore feel I have no alternative except to present the evidence in my possession to the ICC."
"The little shit," said Amelia.
The telephone on the desk started ringing. Then another on a small table beside the door chimed in. For a few seconds, Emilia drummed her fingertips on the desk.
"Right, Unplug all the phones, then start surfing the main news sites to see if you can discover anything else. She grabbed her black and red book and clattered off down the corridor on her high heels. Unsure of what I was supposed to do, I decided I'd better follow her. We climbed the stairs to the living room. Lang was sitting motionless, exactly where I'd left him. The only difference was that he had his own small mobile phone in his hand. He snapped it shut as we came in. "I'd take it from all the telephone calls that he's issued his statement," he said. Amelia spread her hands wide in exasperation. "Why didn't you tell me?" "Tell you before I told Ruth? I don't think that would have been very good politics, do you? Besides, I felt like keeping it to myself for a while." "Sorry," he said to me, "for losing my temper." I was touched by his apology. "Don't worry about it," I said. "Adam, we've got to put a statement out of our own," said Amelia. "If you don't say anything, or if you leave it too long, you'll look..." She hesitated. "Well, they'll draw their own conclusions." "All right," said Lang. "How about this?" Amelia uncapped a small silver pen and opened her notebook. "Responding to Richard Reichardt's statement, Adam Lang made the following remarks. When a policy of offering 100% support to the United States in the global war on terror was popular in the United Kingdom, Mr. Reichardt approved of it. When it became unpopular, he disapproved of it. And when, due to his own administrative incompetence, he was asked to leave the Foreign Office, he suddenly developed a passionate interest in upholding the so-called human rights of suspected terrorists. A child of three could see through his infantile tactics in seeking to embarrass his former colleagues. End point, end paragraph. Amelia had stopped writing midway through Lang's dictation. She was staring at the former Prime Minister. And if I didn't know it was impossible, I'd swear the Ice Queen had the beginnings of a tear in one eye. He stared back at her. There was a gentle tap on the open door. Alice, the secretary, came in, holding a sheet of paper. Lang seemed reluctant to break eye contact with Amelia, and I knew then, as surely as I'd ever known anything, that their relationship was more than merely professional. He took the paper, and as he did so, Ruth came into the study. "Why weren't we given some warning of this?" she demanded. "What are you people doing? I thought the whole point of you was to maintain liaison with the Cabinet Office. You're not telling me they didn't know this was coming." "The ICC prosecutor is very scrupulous about not notifying a suspect if he's under investigation," said Amelia. Her words seemed to stun Ruth. It took her a beat to recover. "So that's what Adam is now, a suspect." She turned to her husband. "You need to talk to Sid Kroll." "We don't know what the ICC are going to say yet," said Lang. "I should talk to London first." "Adam," said Ruth, very slowly, as if he had suffered an accident and might be concussed, "they will hang you out to dry if it suits them. You need a lawyer. Talk to Sid." "And what about the media?" "Issue a holding statement," said Ruth. "Just a sentence or two." Amelia pulled out her mobile and started scrolling through the address book. "Do you want me to draft something?" "Why doesn't he do it?" said Ruth, pointing at me. "He's supposed to be the writer." "Fine," said Amelia, not quite concealing her irritation. "But it needs to go out immediately." I went downstairs with Alice and stood behind her shoulder while she sat at the keyboard, patiently waiting for the ex-Prime Minister's words to flow from my mouth. "I have always been a passionate..." I began. "No, scrap that. I've always been a committed supporter of the work of the International Criminal Court. I have no doubt that the ICC will quickly see through this politically motivated piece of mischief-making. The international struggle against terror is too important to be used for the purposes of personal revenge." Lucy printed it off, and when I took it back up to the study, I felt a curious bashful pride, like a schoolboy handing in his homework. For the first time in my life, I was experiencing the adrenaline of politics. I guess this was how sport must feel when played at its hardest and fastest. It was like tennis on centre court at Wimbledon. Reichardt had fired his serve low across the net, and we had lunged for it, got our racket to it, and shot the ball right back at him with added spin. One by one, the telephones were reconnected. Immediately, they began ringing, demanding attention, and I heard the secretaries feeding my words to the hungry reporters.
I watched my sentences emailed to the news agencies, and within a couple of minutes, on the computer screen and on television, I started seeing and hearing them all over again. The world had become our echo chamber. In the middle of all this, my own phone rang. A faint voice said, "Can you hear me? It's John Maddox from Reinhardt in New York. I've just heard the news. This can only be good for us. We should start with this." "What?"
"This war crime stuff. And you mustn't talk to anyone else about it. We need to keep this absolutely exclusive to the memoirs."
The notion that Lang would be able to avoid saying anything about illegal kidnapping and torture until the book came out was a joke. Although, naturally, I didn't put it in quite those terms to the chief executive of the third largest publishing house in the world.
"I'll tell him, John," I said.
"In the meantime, I want you to accelerate the timetable. It'll probably mean settling for a polish instead of a rewrite, but the earlier we go, the more we'll sell."
By the time he'd hung up, 2 weeks had ceased to be a figure plucked from the air and had become a firm deadline. I went in search of Amelia. To my surprise, one of the policemen told me she was outside. Must have been after 4 by now and getting cold. She was standing in the turning circle in front of the house. In the January gloom, the tip of her cigarette glowed bright red as she inhaled, then faded to nothing. "I wouldn't have guessed you were a smoker," I said. "I only ever allow myself one, and then only at times of great stress or great contentment." "Which is this?" "Very funny." She had buttoned her jacket against the chilly dusk and was smoking in that curious Nolly Metangere way that a certain kind of woman does, with one arm held loosely against her waist and the other, the one with the hand holding the cigarette, slanted across her breast. "I don't suppose there's the faintest chance of my sitting down with Adam for another interview today, is there? And what do you think? In that case, could I have a lift back to my hotel?" It was pretty well dark by the time I got back to Edgartown. I went up to my room and took my laptop out of my shoulder bag. I dialed my internet service provider, and while the connection was going through, I went into the bathroom for a glass of water. From the other room, I heard the familiar announcement, "You have email." I saw at once that something was wrong. There was the usual queue of junk messages offering me everything from penis enlargement to the Wall Street Journal. Just about the only thing that wasn't listed was the email I had sent myself that afternoon. I took out my mobile and called the internet company, but the bottom line was that the manuscript had vanished, and the company had no record of it ever having existed. Somehow, Lang's manuscript had been wiped from the memory of my internet service provider's computers. But how could that have happened? Deletion would imply that someone had direct access to the computers of one of the world's biggest internet conglomerates and was able to cover their tracks at will. It would also imply that my emails were all being monitored.